This week's parsha, Parsha Ki Tetzeh, has over 70 mitzvos that are found within the parsha. I'd like to focus on the first halacha, the first law that's found within the parsha, which seemingly has absolutely no relevance to our lives. And that's really the first question I'd like to ask ourselves, is how do we look at, how do we understand a part of the parsha which is so distant from our lives, which perhaps had tremendous relevance at that particular time. But we know the Torah is eternal. We know that the mitzvot have applications for all times. How perhaps we understand this mitzvah on a much deeper level, a much more maybe perhaps symbolic level, that we can draw lessons for our lives. And I'll say at the outset that it's one of the most challenging, difficult halachos, whose details I don't want to work through. So the problems that are found here and the questions that are raised here need to be answered, need to be discussed. Not today. Let's take a look at the mitzvah. When you will go out to war against your enemies, and Hashem your God will deliver them into your hands, and you will capture its captivity. And you'll see among its captivity a woman who is a beautiful form, and you'll desire her. You may take her to yourself for a wife. You shall bring her to the midst of your house. She shall shave her head and let her nails grow. She shall remove the garment of her captivity from upon herself and sit in your house, and she shall weep for her father and for her mother for a full month. Thereafter you may come to her and live with her, and she shall be a wife to you. And that's the process of conversion. But it shall be that if you do not desire her, you shall send her on her own, but you may not sell her for money. You shall not enslave her because you have afflicted her. This is basically the process of you've desired this woman, but clearly you've desired her on a superficial level for beauty reasons alone. Therefore, you remove the beauty and look at the person, as a human being. Do you still desire her? And as Rashi points out, your wife who's sitting at home is beautiful and is always happy. This one is sitting ugly and is crying. Do you still want her? If you still want her after this process, then you're allowed to take her. And if not, you have to send her away. But you may not sell her for money. You can't enslave her. You can't afflict her. You have to treat her like a person. And that's key, Menschlichkeit, within Yiddishkeit. We don't go out to war, my friends, today. We don't take these beautiful women today. First question is, what's its message? What is it teaching us? What are we to learn from it? The second question I'd like to deal with today is the time that we're in, and we're moving closer and closer, my friends. Time doesn't stop to Rosh Hashanah. The question becomes, what is the mindset? What should we be working on? We spoke a little bit about it last week. Again, the question this week, what should we be working on during the month of Elul? How can we improve ourselves? What should be the mindset? What should be the game plan, so to speak, for this month? It's the second question that I really want to focus in on, utilizing the first question as a vehicle to respond to the second. We know that in order to tap into the essence of what a month is about, we really need to look at what happened historically in that month. And we do this throughout the calendar year, whether it's Rosh Hashanah was the creation of man, right? Adam and Chava were created on the sixth day of creation, which if the world was created Kafei Elul, the sixth day becomes Rosh Hashanah Aleph Tishrei. So therefore, if it's the creation of man, we recreate ourselves every Rosh Hashanah. That's what Rosh Hashanah is about. It's about recreation. Pesach is about Yetziat Mitzrayim. Historically, we left Egypt. Therefore, it's a time that we're able to break out of the bonds of our lives, whatever that may be. So that's what life is about. Life is about to look at historically what happened during this month. And then if you understand historically what happened, so then you're able to tap into the energy that's found, that pulsates specifically in this month. The question we become is, well, what happened historically in the month of Elul? So we know that when Moshe Rabbeinu originally gave the Torah to Klal Yisrael, the first Luchos was on Shavuot. And then 40 days later, Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't come down. People build the Egel HaZahav, they build the golden calf. Moshe Rabbeinu comes down on Yudzayin Tammuz and breaks the Luchos, breaks the tablet, goes up another 40 days to ask for forgiveness, comes down again, and then goes up again for the third 40 days. Moshe Rabbeinu is up ultimately three rounds of 40 days. He comes up the third 40 days and he ascends Rosh Chodesh Elul in order to get the second Luchos and full Mechila and full forgiveness for the Jewish people. And that's why Yom Kippur, the end of the 40 days, right? Elul, he goes up the third round. He goes up Rosh Chodesh Elul, 30 days in Elul, 10 days in Tishrei. So Yom Kippur becomes the 40th day when we get the Torah again. And that's really, in a certain sense, a second Shavuot. And that's how they explain on a certain level that Sukkot is like the Sheva Brachot of the remarriage, so to speak, of Klal Yisrael, or now the cemented marriage is a better way of saying it, between God and the Jewish people with the new Luchos. And that's why Yom Kippur becomes the day of Slicho Mechila, a day of forgiveness for us, because historically, that's when Kadosh Baruch Hu said to Moshe, Klal Yisrael is forgiven. So Rosh Chodesh Elul becomes the time when Moshe Rabbeinu is looking for forgiveness for the Jewish people. So if Moshe Rabbeinu is looking for forgiveness for the Jewish people, so therefore it becomes a time of forgiveness for whom? For us. It's built into the system. This is the time of forgiveness, which culminates in Yom Kippur. And indeed, our rabbis tell us that they blew the shofar when Moshe ascended so that they wouldn't lose count. And that's one of the reasons why there's a custom to blow the shofar every day of Wad, of the month of Elul. That's where it comes from, too, historically. Now, having said this, let's take this much deeper. If Elul becomes the time where Moshe Rabbeinu was trying to get forgiveness for the Jewish people because they worshipped the golden calf, so therefore it's a time to examine, well, what was the sin of the golden calf that they needed to get forgiveness for? What exactly is the sin that we're dealing with here that needs forgiveness? So the logical answer is, what's the sin of the golden calf? Is clearly what? Thank you, Zavada Zara. But says the Siftei Chaim, much deeper than that, and it's very powerful. He says, when you look at the pasuk that Kadosh Baruch Hu really condemns the Jewish people, source 5, he says, Ra'iti et ha'am hazeh, v'hine am k'shei orefu. I look at these people, and I see that they are an am k'shei oref, a stiff-necked people, and therefore I want to destroy them. Now, this is very interesting. He doesn't say, Kadosh Baruch Hu doesn't say, God doesn't say, I looked at these people and I told them this is a people that worships idols. Because if it's a people that worships idols, so you can train them in what? They won't worship idols. But we see here something much deeper. It's not just the question of worshiping idols, that you can correct. What was it that really was saying, that Kadosh Baruch Hu was saying, I'm forced to destroy the people? Is that beneath this desire to worship idols is something much deeper. It's a psychological problem, and that's called what? Stubbornness. That's called stiff-neckedness. If a person is stubborn and stiff-necked, as Rashi explains there, Machzirim koshi or pam l'negin mochicheihem umim'anim lishmoa, they refuse to listen. They turn their back on those who try to correct them, those who try to bring them on the right path. If a person refuses to listen, so then such a person really has no hope, because you're not giving them direction in life, or they refuse to take that direction. So this is really on one of the deepest levels. What does Moshe Rabbeinu have to really work through in terms of getting forgiveness for the people? Is to try to make the people understand that the forgiveness that is necessary is not so much on the fact that they worshipped idols, but on the fact that they were so caught in their mindset that they refused to listen to others. They refused to listen to Hur, they refused to listen to Aaron. They were set in that which they wanted to do. And that, my friends, is really, I think, for our purposes, the bedrock of Elul. Elul is a time to understand is that the biggest problem, one of the biggest problems that we have to grapple with within our own lives, is to do tshuva for this type of complacency. Whereas he says so beautifully at the end of 8, where he says, we have our own tshiat ha'oref. We have our own stubbornness in our own lives. And that is, and it's a wonderful description, he says, Chaim, second paragraph, third line,
Chaim Beli Hitbonanut, it's a life without contemplation. We look at ourselves as basically good people. Okay, so we have here and there things that are wrong. But you know what, overall, you know, we're all decent, good people. That attitude is a very problematic attitude. Because if you have that attitude, so anytime you hear somebody trying to make you a better person, what do you say? Well, it's not pertaining to me. It must be for that other person. You know, Rabbi Left tells that story. He said he saw so clearly what it's like to be in the American rabbinate when he was a Rav in Miami for a number of years. He said that he wanted to give Musar to a particular person. So he gave a whole drusha that was really aimed for this person. And this person came over to him afterwards and said, Rabbi, you really gave it to them. It was a great speech. Totally oblivious to the fact that it was directed at him. But that, my friends, is life. And that's how we look at things. Yeah, that's for the other guy. Me, I'm doing great. I'm doing fine. That is really what Elul's about. And he quotes here Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who says that in the olden days, the shofar was enough to wake us up. And he says it's interesting that the shofar doesn't even have the power that it used to have. That even the shofar, we listen to it and say, very nice, but it doesn't really get us out of the root. It, for many of us, it doesn't have that effect. And he suggests it's a study of Musar. If you study ethical work, then you recognize where you've gone wrong, so then you can improve yourself. I will argue so much to say that even that has little effect, unfortunately, on today's generation. What is it that's going to spark and really get people to wake up and to contemplate? That's really the question at hand here. Because, and that's really on level one, this is what we're going to develop in Mirtz Hashem, what Elul is about. Elul is about the recognition and the understanding that it's a time to recognize that we are in a mindset that we don't feel we need to improve. The moment we recognize this, the moment we're ready to improve. And that has to be recognition one. Recognition, number one, has to be, let me step back and say there's room for improvement. There's room to break out of this apathy and this complacency. And I think this is what's reflected on the first understanding, the first level, symbolically, of what this Eishet Yifat Torah is about. Rabbi Miller, in Shabbat Shirim, quotes the Zohar that says that when she cries for a month for her mother and father, so he says, the Hahi Yarcha de Elul. This month corresponds to the month of Elul. So he notes that's a little bit strange because the war could be happening in any month. The month that she cries in is not specifically Elul. What does the Zohar mean when it finds a relationship, a correspondence, between the month of Elul and the month of cry? And he further quotes the Machloket in the Gemara between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva, when she cries for her mother and father, is it literally her mother and father, the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer? Or is it, as Rabbi Akiva notes, that she's crying for the idols that she worshipped, based on a pasuk in Jeremiah, that you turn to the tree and say, you are my father, you are the one who gave birth to me. That the idolatry is referred to as really the parents of a person. So Rabbi Miller says, well, what's going on here? What is, on a more symbolic level, the crying of this particular girl, how it relates to our lives? Right, so let's talk about this. So he says the following. He says that we know that there's a mitzvah in this week's parsha of the shooing away the mother bird in order to take the little eggs. So there's two very famous stories in the Gemara, and the stories are the exact same stories with radically different conclusions. Once there was a boy whose father said to him, go up to the tree, shoo away the mother bird, and take the nest. The boy did so, fell, and died. Now, we know that the Torah tells us two mitzvos that have reward for long life. And they are listening to your parents and shooing away the mother bird. So here the kid is doing both. He's listening to his parents and he's shooing away the mother bird. So apparently this happened more than once. Once Rabbi Yaakov saw this happen, and he said clearly when the Torah says that you get long life, it's not a reference to long life in this world, it's reference to long life in the ultimate world, the spiritual world. And that's what this child is starting to get for listening to his parents and for shooing away the mother bird. Rabbi Elisha ben Avuya saw the same thing. And when he saw that, he said, there can be no God in heaven. How can this be if this are two mitzvot that are promised this reward and the child is dying, and therefore he left Judaism and he turned away completely. And that's why he's known as Acher, the other one. So obviously the question becomes, how can two individuals witness the same situation and come away, both are Tanaim, both are great rabbis, and come away with radically different conclusions that led to radically different ways of their life? So he knows. In answer to this question, the Ozayim LaTorah quotes the Gemara, which tells us that whenever Acher stood up from learning in the house of study, piles of heretical literature would fall from his lap. Before coming to learn Torah, therefore, his mind was already imbued with heresies. The seeds of doubt had already been sown, and his mind could no longer bear the harvest of truth. Rabbeinu Bachya further develops this idea of the importance of the basic studies to which one exposes oneself. One should, he stresses, open oneself first of all to the wisdom of Torah and afterwards to other studies, because the foundation of man's intellect should be rock firm in truth. A shifting quicksand is a dangerous basis for construction. This is in fact really the key in all of our education of our children as well, that the key has to be that we have a firm bedrock before a child, before any individual, goes out and studies other literature. I've often had young ladies who've called me up from Columbia, from U of P, different universities, saying, do you know what they're teaching? How do you then reconcile this with Judaism? The fact that a kid is calling up and asking the question is already 100 feet of a step forward. Because there are many young people who say, well, it doesn't reconcile, and then decide which path to take. That's what he's saying here, is that it's not a question of not opening yourself up to the other world, but what do you need first? A firm foundation. At least you know how to navigate the waters. At least you know where you are. What are the Yesodos HaEmuna? Because it's fascinating what they teach out there. And these kids say that we don't have the gumption to stand up and defend our position. And they're suddenly, you know, overwhelmed. 35, 40 people, very sophisticated, intellectual, are arguing a point against where we're at. We obviously can't be right. And it really leads to a tremendous amount of friction if not handled properly, if not handled correctly. I remember one such young lady. We picked up our messages in Israel, and she called up. And I said to my husband, I'm going to call back because I don't want to let this hang till another 2 weeks till we're back in the States. I didn't tell this young lady where I was calling from. Just responded to the phone call. Let it be on my dime, but let it be at least, you know, a proper perspective. Now, what's the point here? And this is the key point. The point is that if you have the proper bedrock, the proper perspective, so you can build on it. If you don't have the proper perspective, so then you're dealing with quicksand. When we're talking about Elisha ben Avuya, we're talking about an individual who basically was studying this heretical literature, and that's where his mindset was at. And therefore, it was very easy for him to take any one story and allow that, any one incident, and allow that to turn him off the right path. And he develops in this essay the importance of understanding that our first impressions, that which we build our foundation, is really the one that has such an impact on our lives. And he quotes the Maharal, it's very fascinating, that says that according to Jewish law, a judge cannot hear one side of the story on one day and then wait another day to hear the other side of the story. Why? Even if he'll hear both sides of the story.
Because once he hears one side of the story, if he immediately doesn't hear the other side, on some level he's biased and prejudiced that the first story he heard is what? Is the correct story. And that's where it's at in life. We are very much taken by first impressions. We're very much connected to that which we build on. Now, based on this, 13 is because of this deep human characteristic that the Torah allotted the captive girl a whole month to weep for her idols. The beliefs and habits of childhood, however false or absurd, are not easily eradicated. For this girl, it was all her basic conceptions that had to be changed. And for this, a month of introspection and contemplation was not excessive. This aspect is what moved the sages to compare this month with the month of Elul. Elul is a time of self-examination and self-criticism. 30 days are given us every year to review the thoughts and attitudes, as well as the deeds of the past year, to discriminate between those that bore the stamp of truth and those that were tainted with falsehood. What does it mean that this month is a month of Elul? Just as this month has the characteristic of recognizing these are our basic beliefs and foundations for this young lady, and to have to work them through and eradicate them. And it takes a process. It's a recognition and then the eradication. That's what Elul is about. Elul is about, first step, the Kshayorek, to recognize that we are not easy to change. And then the second aspect is, once we're open to that, to say to ourselves for an entire month, well, where are we that we're so set in our ways that we refuse to listen, we refuse to be open? The 30 days of Elul is a time to say to ourselves, have I gotten myself into a rut of habit that I'm doing these things because this is the way I'm doing it? And recognize that just because I've done it this way, just because I've built up my life this way, and we're so into that which we've done becomes for us a truth, it doesn't necessarily have to be a truth. Like, I heard this great conversation. You can hear great conversations in Ralph's on cell phones. Last week, with the checkout counter, this lady was saying to whoever she was talking to, you know, since so-and-so started therapy, they're a completely different person. Then you hear the person responding, and she says, no, I'm not angry, but you shouldn't expect me to change. I'm happy with the way I am. I'm not planning on changing at all. I thought that's a great line. That's a great Elul line. That's life. You don't expect me to change. If they want to change, go get some hay. Of course, she was angry. She was furious, but that was okay. But the point is what? Her defensiveness that she refused to change. That's what Elul is about. Elul is saying that, you know what? Just because I've acted a certain way for so long doesn't necessarily mean that that way is the correct way. Elul is a time for reexamination and saying, are we really acting the way we should be? And don't answer me force of habit, because force of habit has a tremendous impact. That's why this woman has to cry for a full month. But that's not an excuse that necessarily that which you are doing is correct. Now, when we're talking about changing, when we're talking about looking at ourselves and reexamining, it's really within three dimensions. And these are the three key dimensions I want to speak about today. It's within the dimension of ourselves, of God, and the community. And here Rabbi Left, in an introduction to Rabbi Nebenzahl's book of Ani L'Dodi, Thoughts on Elul. So Rabbi Left has an introduction in this book where he says that aside from Ani L'Dodi, the Dodi Li, which is the acronym that spells out Elul, the rabbis give a number of acronyms. One is Umal Hashem Elokechem Es Levavcha Ves Levavzarecha. Hashem, your God, will circumcise your heart and the heart of your offspring, the first letters of which also spell Elul. We must be responsive to this arousal, which removes all the partitions and obstacles between us and our Creator, and obfuscates our recognition and sensitivity to God. So things that block our recognition of God, that has to be what Elul is about in our relationship with God. But Elul is also a time when the Jewish people reunited to achieve the ability to once again receive the Torah, which we spoke about as Yom Kippur, as one person with one heart. To completely receive God's Torah emanating from His oneness, the Jewish people must be a unified entity. And this is a Rosh HaTevot that few of us focus in on Elul, which is key. And that is in 17, a pasuk from Megillas Esther, that you send gifts
ish l'reyehu, one man to his fellow, umatanos levyonim, and each, and gifts to the poor. Ish l'reyehu, matanos levyonim, also spell out Elul. What does this mean? It's telling us that Elul is not just a time to work on our relationship with God or our relationship with self, but Elul is also a time to work on a relationship with whom? With the community, with the people around us. And this is often negated. And he says so beautifully, therefore the essence of Elul is Ani L'Dodi V'Dodi Li. I must rediscover my Ani, my essence, my identity as an individual, which is what this whole contemplation process is about, and as part of the Jewish people. I must also identify the Dodi, who my beloved actually is, and then automatically the Dodi Leo discover that my beloved is indeed close to me, standing ready to embrace me. Thus, Elul is a time of introspection, contemplation, a time of defining perspective and role, a time of becoming better acquainted with our friends, neighbors, and the community of the Jewish people. And that's really a wonderful exercise to do in the month of Elul, is to go to the park, and to, it's a great exercise to try, and to like close our eyes and to imagine ourselves from an observer perspective. Like step outside of yourself. It's great to do this, where you go through your day watching yourself from moment go to the end of the day, but you're not in yourself. You're watching as a third person observer. And then you can be very critical. And you can say, you know, this person called for the third time. And you watch yourself saying, you know what, I will have a call again and then I'll answer the phone call. And then you as a third person observer say, this person called three times. Don't you have the decency to call the person back? Or the person's asked you to be involved in a certain communal project. And you say, I don't have time for it. And then you look back at a third person and you say to yourself, but you could make time for it if you really valued its importance. And it's a great conversation to have, to see the real you. I don't know which one's the real you. To see you as you function within this world. And then to step back and to say, well, how could I, if I were to be able to critique and give advice to this person as an outsider, because I know them so intimately, how could I make this person a better person in terms of self, in terms of community, in terms of God? And that's what Elul is about. Elul is about looking at where we're at where we would want to be. And where we would want to be is me too. It's looking at me as a better person, as a more pristine person. And that tension is really what's going to help a person grow in the Elul period. It's going to be able to see the discrepancy between both and be able to grow from that experience. Now, having said this, I think we've been looking at Elul so far really on a reflective level, on almost a passive level. But as we spoke about, there is that Sur Merah, and then there's also the Aseh Tov. I think in order to really be successful with Elul, you have to be proactive as well. And I think that is hinted at in the first phrase of our parsha. And this is the message of, one message, the eternal message of this mitzvah. And that's ki tetzei l'melchama ol oyvecha, when you go out to war against your enemy. The war against our enemy that we're speaking about here, that all the Balei Musar are speaking about here, is the war that we need to fight in all three arenas, between man and God, between man and self, and between man and man. Let's understand. Between man and God. In the Garden of Torah, Lubavitcher Rebbe, he says, when you go out to battle against your enemies, in the soul's natural environment, the spiritual world above, there is no conflict. However, when the soul goes out from that sending and descends to our material world, it is confronted by challenges that may require to engage in battle. For there are two aspects of material existence. Our world was created because God desired a dwelling in the lower world. The physical universe can serve as a dwelling for God, a place where his essence is revealed.
But as the term lower world implies, God's existence is not readily apparent in our environment. On the contrary, the material nature of the world appears to preclude holiness. An attempt to resolve these two contradictory thrusts is often characterized by conflict. And this is the Torah's conception of war on the first level, a struggle to transform even the lowest elements of existence into a dwelling for God. That is our first battle. And I think that this is key, perhaps more than anything else we've discussed today, is this concept. If one thinks that one is placed in this world to sit back and have a good time, you know, it was the first rude awakening I had coming to L.A. when I taught a sixth grade class, and I would give them work. I'll never forget this. And they said to me, "This is Smiles. This is L.A. We surf. We go out on the beach. We have a good time. We're relaxed. No pressure." That was my rude awakening to L.A. If this is the whole incident of Yosef, therefore came upon him. If you think life is about, you know, you take it easy, you relax, occasionally, you know, you're going to come into some bumps and some conflicts along the road, then we've misunderstood what life is about. Life, by definition, of a holy soul coming down to this world is about going out to battle. Understand that. And if you understand that, then you'll be successful in battle. That life is about constantly struggling. And if we go through a day and we haven't struggled, then you know what, my friends? We failed today. Because life is not about sitting back and being in comfort. When I say it to my husband, I just want to, you know, to relax, have an easy life. After 120 years, we'll have plenty of time to have an easy life. If you're here in this world, you're here in this world to do what? You're here in this world, by definition, is to struggle. Struggle doesn't necessarily mean pain, my friends. Struggle means that you're going to have to overcome aspects of life, and that's what makes you what? A good person. That's what makes you who you are. We know this ourselves. The more we work at something in life, the more it becomes what? More precious to us, more special to us. So battlefront number one in life is to recognize that we live in a very, very materialistic world, in a world that blocks any aspect of holiness. Battlefront number one is to be able to really move away all that darkness, all that distance from God, and to say that whatever I'm involved in, whatever I do, I can elevate it to a holy experience. So we don't have to come to Elul, Rosh Hashanah, and suddenly say, "Hello, you know, there's a God in the world. I've been dealing with this God when I eat. I've been dealing with this God when I go out and take a walk. I've been dealing with this God on every physical level. Because my soul is here to take the physical and elevate it to the spiritual." And I ask myself that. How am I living a spiritual existence within the physical world? It's a battlefront. Every time I'm involved in any physical pleasure, I'm battling. That's where blessings come in. That's where bringing godliness in is all about. It's saying that I'm struggling and I need to overcome the struggle. That's between man and God. Then you have, as the Nesivah Shalom points out, and this is very powerful. He says that from the moment that the child is born into this world, the child is born into a world of struggle. And we're here, each and every one of us, to accomplish a certain mission in this world. And we've spoken about this concept over and over again, that we're here to do a mission. But there's a new component we've never spoken about before, which he mentions in 26. And that is, aside from the struggle, the mission that we're here to do in this world, when you go out to war against your enemy, the enemy in this case, and it's very fascinating, is that each and every one of us have a negative character trait, which is the primary character trait that we need to work on within our lifetime. Now, for some of us, that may be anger. For some of us, that may be honor. For some of us, that may be jealousy. Okay, so we're all filled with a mixture, like a chelon pot, of negative traits. It's reality. But he says, we all know that there's one trait within us that rears its head over and over again. Why are you put into this world? You're put into this world to be able to overcome that negative trait. And just like in battle, you have to be moser nefesh, you have to give your all for it. This is the battle you have to do. And after 120 years, you come to God and God says, were you involved in Torah mitzvot? Were you a good person? You say yes. And you say, were you successful in overcoming this trait? Well, you know what, God, this was too overwhelming. You know, you have people who say that
What do you want from me? I was born angry. I was born angry. So if I was born angry, so therefore I'm an angry person. You know, that's where I was at. You know, it's nature versus nurture. I'm an angry person. You're right. So if you were born angry, you're lucky that you know you were born angry. Then you know what, at least? That's what you have to work on. You have to work on anger. You have to work on jealousy. That's the second aspect of battle in life. That you have to find, well, what is it, that major character trait that's so overwhelming, that's so all-encompassing in your life? And that's what you have to work on. That's what you're going to have to take a battle front with. That's the battle between you and yourself. And there's a final battle that I'd like to speak about, that the Siva Shalom speaks about in 27. And that is in terms of the way we view other people in this world. And he says there are two major principles that we need to remember at all times. The first is the verse, Vasita Hayasha Vatov. You should do that which is upright and good in God's eyes, which is the whole concept of Lifni Mishurat Adin, going above and beyond the letter of the law. And the second aspect is Kedoshim Tiyu, to be holy, not to be a Navel B'Shus HaTorah, not to overindulge in that which the Torah has given you permission to enjoy. But I think it's this first case that's our final battle between man and fellow man, and that's called being a mensch. You know, so often in life we are right, but being right doesn't mean that you're right. And we all know what that means. Someone's done you something wrong, and you're right. They should what? Call and apologize. You're right, they should. But what does it take to go lifnei mishurat hadin, above and beyond, and call the person up and say, you know what, I'll tell you, I'm a little bit upset about what happened. I want to clear the air between us. Or something that's going to bridge that gap to give them the opportunity to approach you. So often in life we stand on our principles. They should take the initiative. They should do this. They should do that. You're right. But you know what lifnei mishurat hadin means? And it really means being a mensch. It means going above and beyond. And if you don't think it's a battle, you're wrong. Because so much of us says, you know what? Let them pick up the phone. Let them take the initiative. Let them. You're right. But it's a battle, my friends. Life is about battling. Life is about struggle. Life is about saying, I know that that is what should be done, but I'm going to be a bigger person than that. I'm going to be the one who's going to take the initiative. I'm going to be the one who's going to judge the person for the benefit of the doubt, even though it's difficult to do that, because I want to go above and beyond. Now, here's really where the key is at. Let's just stop for a moment, see what we've developed, and then just take this a little bit further. Elul is about recognizing the Kshei Oref, that we are stuck in our ways, that we don't even recognize that we need to improve. First part of Elul is to open ourselves up and say we need to improve. Once we've said that, we have to recognize that it takes a month to really look at our lives and say, just because I've lived this way for so long doesn't mean it's necessarily right. That month of the Eishes Yifat Tovah, the month of contemplation, to really be able to see truth from falsehood. Be able to step outside of ourselves and see who we really could become. And it has to be on three levels, between ourselves and God, between ourselves and ourselves, and between ourselves and our fellow man. Having said this, we need to understand that life is not just recognizing this on a contemplative level. Life is about being more proactive, and to understand that we need to fight battles on every day on each one of these fronts. Ask ourselves, am I living a materialistic life, or am I able to elevate it to a spiritual life? Ask myself, am I working on this character trait every day? Ask myself, am I working on trying to be a mensch every day? And it's a wonderful exercise, my friend, is before you go to sleep, to have like a journal, a diary, with three columns, and be able to write an incident in each column of, yes, I worked on elevating one thing today for God. That when I ate today, I really felt I'm eating in order to be able to serve God better. I'm sleeping in order to have energy to serve God. That I generally get angry, but today, once, I counted to 10 before I got angry. That I generally didn't do so-and-so today, I gave the person the benefit of the doubt. And if you're able every day to be able to at least check off two out of the three columns, then you know what? Then you're on the right path. And they say that if you're not able to at least fight in each area during the day, so then your life was a very passive life that day. It wasn't about what life is about of going forward. Now, three considerations when fighting a battle that we need to keep in mind. And this will be our final ideas for today. Consideration number one that Nesiva Shalom speaks about is that famous line we say in our davening of Haser Satan Milfaneinu Umeacharenu. Remove the Satan from in front of us and from behind us. What does this mean? So explain to Nesiva Shalom. Is that very often a person says, oh, what a big battle ahead of me. It's just too hard to fight. And then the person also says, you know what? I've been so unsuccessful in the past. Why should I go on now? I'm never going to win anyway. Idea number one is not to look ahead at the future of how many battles are left to fight, not to look behind us and say, well, look how unsuccessful I've been, but rather to do what? Deal at the moment. If you're going to fight a war, you don't think about, well, what will be tomorrow, what was yesterday. Your focus has to be what? The here and now. That story, which perhaps we've mentioned in the past, but I'll mention it again. I find it a very powerful story. Found at the beginning of Shlomo Karbach's Haggadah. You spoken about this? Where he was in Waco, Texas, on an Erev Shabbos. I don't know if any of you have been to Waco, Texas. And he was about to go to the mikvah. It's a custom for, you know, some Jews to go to the mikvah every Erev Shabbos. And as he's about to go into the mikvah, a car pulls up with this typical Texan cowboy. You know, the hat, the boots, the jacket. You got the picture. Also ready to go into the mikvah. Shlomo Karbach looks at him and says, you know, in his mind, this is not the typical candidate for mikvah, Erev Shabbos. It's not even Erev Yom Kippur. This is like an Erev Shabbos. So the man sees his quizzical look and says, you're probably wondering what I'm doing going to the mikvah on an Erev Shabbos. To say the least, yes, he was quite interested. So he tells him the following story. He says to him that when he was a child, his father was a Vishnitzer Chassid. And they were in Russia. And before they left Russia, he was a small boy, 6, 7, and a chvesh. He was a young boy. Before they left Russia, they went to a Vishnitzer Tish. If you've ever seen a Tish, you have thousands of Hasidim who are piled on top of each other, listening to every word of the Rebbe, trying to get every morsel of food from the Rebbe. You know what a Tish is like. So he said, my father was concerned that I'd get trampled. So what did he do? He put me under the Rebbe's table, told the Rebbe I'm there, and that way I wouldn't be, you know, clobbered by all these big men. I'm a tiny child. And the Rebbe was very nice to me, this man said. He gave me food. You know, he would talk to me during the meal. He was very nice. And then the Rebbe got up and he gave the following Dvar Torah. He says, in life, sometimes a person has a ha'ara, has a spirit to do a mitzvah. And then the Yetzirah says, but you're going to do this mitzvah. 5 minutes ago you did an aveira. 5 minutes from now you're going to sin. So who do you think you are? Who are you fooling yourself that you're going to do a mitzvah right now? Get real. You know, there's a reality here. He says, don't listen to that Yitzhara. He says, because if you have an inspiration to do a mitzvah, so act on it. What happened 5 minutes ago, what happened 5 minutes from now is irrelevant. And he said, then the vision of the Rebbe turned to me and says, I don't want you ever to forget this. And he said, I have long since steered away from the life of the vision of Hasidim. He says, I eat on Yom Kippur. I don't keep Shabbos. I'm totally a secularized Jew. He says, I never forgot that lesson of the vision of the Rebbe. And today, I had the spirit to go to the mikvah, Erev Shabbos. And I said to myself, get real. You eat on Yom Kippur. You don't keep Shabbos. You're going to go to the mikvah. And then I remembered what the vision of the Rebbe said. You don't think about what was. You don't think about what will be. You do what? The here and now. And I'm here, I'm going to the mikvah. That is understanding number one when we battle in life, is that you have to understand that you're right. Part of you says, this is an uphill battle to work on myself. It's an uphill battle to judge others favorably. Life is an uphill battle. Why should I struggle?
The answer is, you have a situation right now, look at it right now, deal with it, and be able to respond to the here and now. Item number two of the three is source 31, and this is crucial, is that when you go out to battle, the language of the Torah is ki teitzei. When you go out to battle, you should not wait until the battle front comes to you. Because if the battle front comes to you, so very often you're caught off guard and you're not ready to be able to be successful. And that, you say, teaches is on the Vayavo Amalek, and Amalek came to battle with us. We are Birfidim, literally the place of weakened hands. Why were we weakened hands? Because Amalek came to fight us. It's ki teitzei milchama l'adecha. One has to be proactive in battling in life. One always has to take situations and say, well, let me be proactive with the situation. Let me be on the offense rather than on the defense. And then you'll be much more successful in war. If you're just going to wait till situations come to you, and then you're going to respond to them, so often you're going to respond from a point of weakness and won't be successful. And perhaps the final point, and this is the last point for today, is where, again, Lubavitcher Rebbe says, a person must challenge himself, and this means more than a commitment to gradual progress. Serving God involves breaking our individual natures and showing that there are no limits to our commitment to Him. And this endeavor involves a constant struggle. A person cannot reach a level of spiritual achievement and then rest on his laurels. Instead, he must continually strive to advance further. The inner battles necessary to bring this commitment to the fore tap the essential and unbounded divine potential each of us possesses within our souls. And I think this is the key point, that life is about a continual battle. Ki teitzei, when you go out to war, is constant, not one-time battling. That you have to understand that you can never step back and say, I've reached it. That's not life. Life is about every day saying, I'm going to find battles, and I'm going to find more than one battle in a day. And life is about keeping on going. But what do we have to remember, and this is the key I'd like to conclude with, is that we're going with the understanding that we have a godly soul within us. Unetano Hashem Elokecha Be'adecha. God will give the enemy into your hand, that we're not fighting alone. We're fighting with God. And that when we speak about Elul, we're speaking about a time when God is in the field. We're speaking about a time of contemplation, a time of battle, a time of challenging ourselves to look at who we are, who we can be, how we can develop, what are our battle fronts. When we examine all of these areas, we have to keep one thing in mind, that if we think we can do this alone, we're mistaken. We have to understand that we're battling with a divine soul within us. We have a tremendous amount of power within us, and particularly in Elul, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Kadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm extending my hand, I'm going to give you a help, that we're going to find that if we take the initiative on Nila Dodi, then the Dodi Li, we will be more successful than we can imagine, and it's easier than we can imagine, because once we've taken the initiative, Kadosh Baruch Hu responds and says, I'm going to help you, and I'll help you be successful.